dangerous, and I'd never forgive myself if anything happened to you. You've already given me selflessly of your time and trouble, and risked enough. That seemed to make her feel better. I guess someone will have to tell Vedetta you won't be able to make dinner tomorrow. She will be disappointed, Franca smiled. I know I would be, were I her. Chapter 48 Zed grunted with the weight as he slid the saddle off Spider. He was getting too old for this sort of thing, he decided. He smiled at the irony. He flopped the saddle down over a log to keep it off the ground. Spider happily surrendered the rest of the tack, which Zed laid over the top of the saddle. He covered it all with the saddle blanket. The log with the gear lay against the trunk of an old spruce, so it was out of the weather, to an extent, anyway. He stacked pine boughs over the tack, leaning them up against the spruce's trunk, interlocking them, to keep the gear dry as best he could. The drizzle would soon turn to rain, he had no doubt. Spider, free of duty, cropped grass nearby, but kept an eye and an ear to him. It had been a hard 3-day ride across the Drun River and up into the mountains, harder on him than on the horse. The horse wasn't old. Zed, seeing that Spider was happily engaged, turned to his own business. A small stand of a half-dozen spruce screened the view of his destination. He walked quickly along the quiet shore to skirt the trees. Once beyond them, he stepped onto a thumb of rock jutting out, almost as if it were set there as a podium. Hands on hips, Zed looked out over the lake. It was a beguiling spot. Behind him, the thick forest stopped well short of the lake, as if afraid to approach too close, leaving the lone level and gentle access, but for the few brave spruce, empty of trees. The peninsula was covered here and there with brush, but mostly it held thick tufts of grasses. Small blue and pink wildflowers cavorted among the grass. Sheer rock walls rose up around the rest of the deep mountain lake. If the isolated and remote stretch of water had a name, he didn't know it. There was no practical way to reach it but this one shore. Across and to the left, the jagged mountains, with a sloping field in their lap, rose up ever higher into the distance, providing little opportunity for much more than scraggly trees here and there to set down tenacious roots. To the right, dark stone cliffs obscured the view beyond, but he knew that past them were more mountains yet. On the other side of the lake, a waterfall cascaded over the edge of a prominent jutting wall of rock. Before him, the calm lake reflected the tranquil scene. The icy waters tumbling into the lake came from the highlands, from the vast lake higher up in the bleak wasteland, where the warfer birds alone watched. These were part of the headwaters of the Damar River, which in turn flowed into the Drun. This cold water, coming from a place of death, would meander down into the Narif Valley below and give life. Behind the waterfall were the ovens. In the rock wall behind that tumbling water, 3,000 years before, through a gateway to the underworld, the chimes had once been entombed, and now they were free. There they awaited their soul. At the very thought, Zed could feel goose flesh, like 1,000 spiders on his legs. He tried again, as he had countless times, to call his gift of magic. He tried his best to convince himself that this time it would come. He spread his arms, lifting them, palms up, toward the sky, as he labored to cajole forth magic. The placid lake saw no magic from him. The mountains waited, and were silent in his failure. Zed, feeling very alone, very old, let out a chesty sigh. He had imagined it 1,000 different ways, but he had never imagined this would be how he died. This was why he couldn't let Richard know it was the chimes themselves that were loose. Richard would not have accepted what Zed intended, what Zed knew he must do. Turning his mind away from the smothering melancholy, he surveyed the lake. He had to keep his mind on what he was doing, or he could easily fail, and his sacrifice would be for naught. If he was going to do this, he intended to do it right. There was satisfaction to be derived in a job well done, even a job such as this one. As he studied the scene with an experienced eye, what at first looked to be peaceful waters now revealed more. The water was alive with things unseen, moving in lurking currents, seething with dark intent. The water was alive with the chimes of death. Zed looked back to the waterfall. He could make out just beyond it the dark maw of the cave. He had to get there, across the water churning with chimes.
Centrosi, Zed opened his arms. I have come to freely offer the soul you seek, my soul. What is mine I surrender to you.
flames boiled out around the column of water, swallowing it in great gouts of fire that roared forth, rolling and tumbling out of the place called the ovens. The fire turned the surface of the lake orange with reflections of its heat. For a moment, the waterfall was rendered steam. Inky black smoke billowed up with the white steam, tangling together in a sinister pillar that marked the maw of death. A clear chime rang out, reverberating through the mountains. Zentrosi had answered. The answer was yes.
Brichani, he called to the water before him. Vasi, he called to the air about him. Let me pass, for I have come to surrender my soul to you all.
The water swirled and turned, as if schooling fish gathered at the shore before him. More, though, the water itself seemed alive, eager, hungry. Zed guessed it was. The air felt thick around him, pressing in, urging him forward. The water rose up and curled in a gesturing motion toward the ovens. The air buzzed with chimes, countless separate bells that together created one crystalline sound. The air smelled as if it were burnt. Since it had already started to rain, Zed didn't see that it really mattered if he got any wetter. He stepped out into the water. Rather than having the swim he expected, he found the surface solid enough to hold him, almost like ice, except it moved. Ripples radiated out from his footsteps, touching and retreating, as if it were no more than a mere puddle he splashed through. Each step he took found support. It was the support of the chimes of Richani, bearing him to his doom, to their queen. Vasi, the chimes of the air, escorted him, a robe of death all around. Zed could feel the touch of the underworld in the air. He could feel the damp death at his feet. He knew each step might be his last. He remembered Juni, the mud people hunter, who had drowned. Zed wondered if Juni had felt the peace he sought, the peace he had been offered before he died. Knowing the purpose of the chimes, Zed strongly suspected that, after tempting with tantalizing tranquility, and before they extracted the life, they delivered their terror. Before he reached the waterfall, something unseen pierced the watery column. Intangible hands split the waterfall in two, leaving an opening in the middle, where he might pass into the cave beyond. Zentrosi, the fire, preferred him reasonably dry, he supposed. Stepping onto the opening in the rock before going through into the cave, he heard Spider let out a snort of censure. Zed turned. The horse stood at the bank, feet spread, muscles tense. Her ears were pinned back, her eyes aglare. Her tail whipped from side to side, slapping her flanks.
It's all right, Spider, Zed called back to the agitated animal. I give you your freedom, Zed smiled. If I don't come back, enjoy your life, my friend. Enjoy your life.
Spider released a drawn-out, angry squeal. Zed gave her a last wave, and the squeal became a deep bellow. Zed turned and stepped beyond the tumbling water into the darkness. Curtain of the waterfall closed behind him. He didn't hesitate. He intended to give the chimes what they wanted, a soul. If he could do it in a way that would preserve his life in the process, he would. But without his magic, he had little hope of accomplishing such a thing as he intended, and at the same time remaining whole. Being first wizard, he had some knowledge of the problem at hand. The chimes needed a soul to stay in the world of life. That was the manner in which they had been conjured forth. More than that, they needed a specific soul, the one promised. Beings from the underworld, and soulless beings at that, would have limitations to their understanding of the concept of what it would be to have a soul, or the nature of the soul they were promised. Naturally, there were certain intrinsic precepts that applied, but beyond that, the chimes were in what was to them an alien world. His only hope was that ignorance. Since Zed was so closely related to Richard, and Richard's life had been passed down through Zed, their souls shared ethereal bonds and connections. Just as in body, their souls were related. In much the way they shared some things, the shape of their mouth, for instance, their souls shared characteristics. Even so, each of them was a unique individual, and therein lay the danger. His hope was that the chimes would mistake his as the soul they needed, take his as the soul they needed, and ultimately, being the wrong one, choke on it, so to speak. It was Zed's only hope. He knew no other way to stop the chimes. With each passing day, the threat to the world of life grew more grave. Every day people died. Every day magic grew weaker. As much as he wished to live, he could think of no other way but to forfeit his life to stop the chimes, now, before it was too late. when they opened themselves to the soul they were pledged, and they were thus vulnerable, he hoped his soul would ruin the flow of the spell through which they entered this world. Given that he was a wizard, it was no wild hope. It was, in fact, a reasoned approach, dubious but reasoned. Zed knew that, at the least, such a thing as he planned would disrupt the spell to some extent. Rather like shooting an arrow at an animal meant to kill, but, if off target, wounding at least. What he didn't know was what it would do to him. Zed had no delusions, though. He reasonably expected that what he did, if it didn't strip his soul from him, and in so doing kill him, would anger the Chimes and they would extract their vengeance. Zed smiled. The balance to it was that he would at last again see his beloved Erelin in the spirit world, where he knew her soul waited for him. Inside, the heat was oppressive. The walls were slowly rolling, tumbling, turning, twisting, liquid fire. He was in the beast. In the center of the pulsing cave, Centrosi, the queen of fire, turned her lethal gaze on him. Tongues of flame tasted the air around him. She smiled, a whirl of yellow flame. One last time, Zed made a futile attempt to call his magic. Centrosi rushed toward him with frightening speed, frightening need. Zed felt searing pain through every nerve as unimaginable agony seized his very soul. The world ignited. His scream exploded as a deafening chime. Richard cried out. The pain of the ripping, ringing chime felt as if it splintered his skull. He was only dimly aware of things around him as he tumbled back over the flanks of his horse. The pain of crashing to the ground was a pleasant diversion from the overpowering toll overwhelming his control and driving his scream. He held his head as he curled into a ball in the road, crying uncontrollably with the hurt. The world was fiery agony. All around, people leaped from horses, shrieking orders. Richard could only perceive them as blurry shapes darting about. He couldn't comprehend the words. He couldn't recognize anyone. He couldn't understand anything but the pain. He could do nothing more than maintain his thread of connection to consciousness, to life, as he struggled against the merciless torrent of agony. That he had passed the test of pain, lived through it, as must all who would be wizards, was the only thing that kept him alive. Without the lessons learned, he would already be dead. He was alone in a private inferno. He didn't know how long he could maintain his hold on life. Everything seemed to have gone crazy at once. Beata tore across the grassy ground, running for all she was worth. Terror rampaged through her. Turner's scream had stopped. It had been horrifying while it lasted, but it had only lasted seconds.
Stop!
Beata shrieked with all the power in her lungs.
Stop! Are you crazy? Stop!
The air still reverberated with the sound of the Dominie Dirge. The low-pitched knell lifted dust from the grass, so that it looked like the ground all around was smoking. It trembled and rolled dirt into little balls. It toppled a little lone tree the last squad had planted. It made the whole world vibrate with a ghastly drone. Tears streamed down Beata's cheeks as she raced across the field, shrieking for them to stop ringing the bell. Turner had been out front, scouting on regular patrol to make sure the area before the Dominie Dirge was clear. His scream had ended mere seconds after the Dominie Dirge had been rung, but its pain and horror still echoed inside her head. It was a cry she knew she would never be able to forget as long as she lived.
Stop!
She yelled as she snatched the railing to spin herself around onto the stairs.
Stop!
She cried again as she raced up the steps. Beata burst onto the platform, fists raised, ready to pummel the fool who'd rung the Dominie Dirge. Beata halted, panting madly, looking about. Emmeline stood frozen in wide-eyed shock. Bryce, too, seemed out of his senses. He just stared at her in frozen panic. The long striker used to ring the Dominie Dirge still stood in its holder. Neither of the two up on the platform was even near it. Neither had used the wooden striker to unleash the deadly weapon.
"What did you do?" she screamed at them. "What did you do to ring it? Have you gone mad?"
She glanced over her shoulder to the bony pile of gore that had moments before been Turner. Beata thrust out her arm, pointing.
"You killed him! Why would you do it? What's wrong with you?"
Emmeline slowly shook her head.
"I've not moved a step from this spot."
Bryce was beginning to tremble.
"Me neither, Sergeant. We never rang the thing, I swear. We weren't even near it. Neither of us was near it. We didn't do it."
In the silence, as she stared at them, Beata realized she heard distant screams. She looked off across the plains to the next Dominie Dirge. She could just make out people over there running around as if the world had gone insane. She spun and peered in the opposite direction. It was the same, people screaming, running around. Beata shielded her eyes from the sun and squinted into the distance. There were the remains of two soldiers out in front of their weapon. Estelle Ruffin and Corporal Marie Favel reached what was left of Turner. Estelle, holding fistfuls of her hair, started screaming. Marie turned and started retching. It was the way she was trained. It was the way things were done. They said it had been done that way for millennia. Each squad from each Dominie Dirch sent a patrol out at the same time to scout the area. That way, if there was anything or anyone sneaking around out there, it couldn't simply evade one soldier and hide elsewhere. It wasn't just hers. Every Dominie Dirch down the line had rung of its own accord. Kaelin clutched at Richard's shirt. He was still out of his senses with pain. She couldn't get him out of the ball he had rolled into. She didn't know what exactly was going on, but she feared she knew. He was obviously in mortal danger of some sort. She'd heard him cry out. She saw him tumble off his horse and hit the ground. She just didn't know why. Her first thought was that it was an arrow. She had been terrified it was an arrow from an assassin, and it had killed him. But she could see no blood. Her emotions walled off. She had searched for blood, but on her rapid initial inspection had found none. Kaelin glanced up as 1,000 Dharan soldiers spread out around them. The first instant, when Richard screamed and fell from his horse, without orders from her, they had gone into action. Swords cleared scabbards in a blink. Axes came off belt hangers into ready fists. Lances were leveled. In the perimeter around them, men had flipped a leg over their horses' necks and leaped to the ground ready to fight, weapons all ready to hand. Other men, closing ranks, forming the next circle of protection, turned their horses outward ready to charge. Still more, the outer fringe of crack troops had rushed off to find the assailants and clear the area of any enemy. Kaelin had been around armies her entire life and knew about fighting troops. She knew by the way they reacted that these men were as good as they came. She hadn't needed to issue any orders. They executed every defensive maneuver she would have expected and did them faster than she could have shouted the commands. Above her and Richard, the Baka Taumana blade masters formed a tight circle, swords out and at the ready. Whatever the attack was, arrow or dart or something else, Kaelin couldn't imagine the people protecting them allowing another chance at their Lord Rawl. If nothing else, there were now too many men suddenly layered around them for an arrow to make it through. Kaelin, somewhat stunned by the sudden confusion, felt a flutter of worry that Kara would be angry they let harm come to Richard. Kaelin, after all, had promised to let no harm come to him, as if a promise to Kara were required. Du Chaillu pushed her way between her blade masters to squat down on the other side of Richard. She had a water skin and cloth to dress a wound.
"Have you found the injury?"
"No," Kaelin said as she picked around on him. She pressed a hand to the side of Richard's face. It reminded her of when he'd had the plague, out of his mind with fever and not knowing where he was. He couldn't have been stricken with sickness, not the way he cried out and fell from his horse, but he did feel as if he was burning up with fever. Du Chaillu dabbed a wet cloth against Richard's face. Kaelin saw that Du Chaillu's own face was creased in worry. Kaelin continued her examination of Richard, trying to see if he had been hit by some sort of dart or perhaps a bolt from a crossbow. He was trembling, almost in convulsions. She searched frantically, pulling him onto his side to check his back, trying to find what was hurting him. She concentrated on her job and tried not to think of how worried she was, lest shock take her. Du Chaillu stroked Richard's face when Kaelin eased him onto his back, seeming to discount the need to look for a wound. The spirit woman bent forward, cooing softly in a chant with words Kaelin didn't understand.
"I can't find anything," Kaelin said at last in exasperation.
"You won't," Du Chaillu answered distantly.
"Why's that?"
The Baka Taumana spirit woman murmured fond words to Richard. Even if Kaelin couldn't understand their literal meaning, she understood the emotion behind them.
"It is not a wound of this world," Du Chaillu said.
Kaelin glanced about at the soldiers, wringing them. She put her hands protectively on Richard's chest.
"What does that mean?"
Du Chaillu pushed Kaelin's hands gently away.
"It is a wound of the spirit, the soul. Let me tend to him."
Kaelin pressed her own hand tenderly to Richard's face.
"How do you know that?"
"You don't know that. How could you know?"
"I am a spirit woman. I recognize such things."
"Just because—"
"Did you find a wound?"
Kaelin remained silent for a moment, reconsidering her own feelings.
"Do you know what we can do to help him?"
"This is something beyond your ability to help."
Du Chaillu bowed her head of dark hair
as she pressed her hands to Richard's chest.
"Leave me to it," Dushalu murmured, "or our husband will die."
Helen sat back on her heels and watched as the Baka Ta Mana spirit woman, head bowed and hands on Richard, closed her eyes as if going into a trance of some sort. Words whispered forth, meant for herself perhaps, but not for others. She trembled, her arms shook. Dushalu's face contorted in pain. Suddenly she fell back, breaking the connection. Helen caught her arm lest she topple.
"Are you all right?"
Dushalu nodded.
"My power. It worked. It was back."
Helen looked from the woman to Richard. He seemed calmer.
"What did you do? What happened?"
"Something was trying to take his spirit. I used my ability to annul such power and kept the hands of death from him."
"Your power is back?" Helen was dubious.
"But how could that be?"
Dushalu shook her head.
"I don't know. It returned when the Kaharan cried out and fell from his horse. I knew because I could again feel my bond to him.
Maybe the chimes have fled back to the underworld."
Again Dushalu shook her head.
"Whatever it was, it is passing. My power fades again."
She stared off a moment.
"It is again gone. It was only there long enough to help him."
Dushalu issued quiet orders for her men to stand down, that it was over. Helen wasn't convinced. She glanced again to Richard. It did look like he was calming. His breathing was evening out. His eyes abruptly opened. He squinted at the light. Dushalu leaned over him and pressed the wet cloth to his forehead, dabbing off the sweat.
"You are all right now, my husband," she said.
"Dushalu," he muttered. "How many times do I have to tell you I'm not your husband? You are misinterpreting old laws."
Dushalu smiled up at Kalin.
"See, he is better."
"Thank the good spirits you are here, Dushalu,"
Kalin whispered.
"Tell him that, when he again complains I should leave him."
Kalin couldn't help smiling at Richard's frustration with Dushalu, and with her blessed relief that he was indeed better. Tears now suddenly tried to burst forth, but she banished them.
"Richard, are you all right? What happened? What made you fall from your horse?"
Richard tried to sit up, but Kalin and Dushalu both pushed him back down.
"Both your wives say to rest for a time," Dushalu said.
Richard stopped trying to get up. His gray eyes turned to Kalin. She clutched his arm, again silently thanking the good spirits.
"I'm not sure what happened," he finally said. "It was like this sound, like a deafening bell exploding in my head. The pain was like..."
His face lost some of its color.
"I don't know how to explain it. I've never felt anything like it before."
He sat up, this time brushing their restraining hands aside.
"I'm all right now. Whatever it was, it's gone. It has passed."
"I'm not so sure," Kalin said.
"I am," he said. He looked haunted. "It was like something tearing at my very soul."
"It didn't get it," Dushalu said. "It tried, but it didn't get it."
She was dead serious. Kalin believed her. Hide twitching, the horse stood motionless, her hooves rooted to the grassy ground. Her instinct demanded she run. Ripples of panic quivered through her flesh, but she remained unmoving. The man was beyond the falling water in the dark hole. She didn't like holes. No horse did. He had screamed. The ground had shaken. That had been a long time ago. She hadn't moved since then. Now it was silent. The horse knew, though, that her friend still lived. She let out a long, low bellow. He still lived, but he didn't come out. The horse was alone. There was no worse thing for a horse than being alone. Chapter 49. Anne opened her eyes. She was surprised in the dim light to see a face she had not seen for months, not since she was still the prelate back at the palace of the prophets in Tanamura in the old world. The middle-aged sister was watching her. Middle-aged, Anne amended, if you considered 500 and a few years old to be middle-aged.
"Sister Alessandra,"
forming the words aloud, hurt. Her lip was not healing well. Her jaw still didn't work too well. Anne didn't know if it was broken. If it was, there was nothing for it. It would have to heal as it would. There was no magic to do it for her.
"Prelate,"
the woman greeted, in an aloof tone. She used to have a long braid, Anne recalled, a long braid she always looped around and pinned to the back of her head. Now her graying brown hair was chopped off and hung loose,
not quite touching her shoulders. Anne thought it better balanced her somewhat prominent nose.
I brought you something to eat, Prelate, if you feel up to it.
Why? Why did you bring me something to eat?
His Excellency wanted you fed.
Why you?
The woman smiled just a little. You dislike me, Prelate.
Anne did her best to glare. The way her face was swollen, she wasn't sure she was doing a good job of it.
As a matter of fact, Sister Alessandra, I love you, as I love all the Creator's children. I simply abhor your actions, that you have sworn your soul to the Nameless One.
Keeper of the Underworld, Sister Alessandra's smile grew a little wider. So you can still care about a woman who is a Sister of the Dark? Anne turned her face away. Even though the steaming bowl did smell savory, she didn't want to talk to the fallen sister. In her chains, Anne couldn't feed herself. She unconditionally refused to accept food from the sisters who had lied to her and betrayed her rather than have their freedom. Up until now, soldiers fed her. They disliked the duty. Their distaste for feeding an old woman had apparently resulted in Sister Alessandra's appearance. Sister Alessandra lifted a spoonful of soup to Anne's mouth.
Here, have some of this. I made it myself.
Why?
Because I thought you might like it.
Getting bored, sister, pulling the legs off ants.
My, my, Prelate. But don't you have the memory? I haven't done that since I was a child, first come to the Palace of the Prophets.
As I recall, you were the one who convinced me to stop doing that, recognizing I was unhappy to leave my home.
Here now, have a taste.
Please.
Anne was sincerely surprised to hear the woman say please. She opened her mouth for the spoon. Eating hurt, but not eating was making her weak. She could have refused to eat or done something else to get herself killed, she supposed, but she did have a mission and therefore a reason to live.
Not bad, Sister Alessandra, not bad at all.
Sister Alessandra smiled with what looked to be pride.
I told you so. Here, have some more.
Anne ate slowly, trying to chew the soft vegetables gently so as not to hurt her jaw. She simply swallowed the tough chunks of meat, not even bothering to mash them flat, lest she undo whatever healing her jaw was managing to do.
Your lip looks like it's going to be scarred.
My lovers will be disappointed that my beauty is marred.
Sister Alessandra laughed, not a harsh or cynical laugh, but a lilting laugh of true amusement.
You always could make me laugh, Prelate.
Yes, Anne said with venom. That was why I for so long failed to realize you had joined the side of evil. I thought my little Alessandra, my happy little Alessandra, would not be drawn to the heart of wickedness. I so believed you loved the light.
Sister Alessandra's smile withered.
I did, Prelate.
Bah!
Anne scoffed.
You only loved yourself.
The woman stirred the soup for a time and finally brought up another spoonful.
Perhaps you are right, Prelate. You usually were.
Anne carefully chewed the lumps in the soup as she surveyed the grimy little tent. She had caused such a ruckus being with the Sisters of the Light that Jigang apparently had ordered her to be housed in her own small tent. Each night, a long steel pin was driven into the ground and she was chained to it. The tent was erected around her. In the day, when they prepared to move out, she was thrown in a rough wooden box, latched with a hasp, held tight with a pin or lock of some sort. She wasn't sure, since she was always inside the box when they put it on and took it off. The box with her in it was then loaded on an enclosed wagon without windows or ventilation. She knew because she peeked out the crack where the lid of her box didn't fit well. After they stopped for the night, they eventually took her out, and one of the sisters escorted her to the latrine before they staked her to the ground and put up her tent. If need took her in the day, she had little choice as to what to do about it. It was either wait or don't. Occasionally, they didn't bother with the tent and simply left her chained to the stake like a dog. Anne had come to like her little tent and was pleased when it was erected around her. It was her private sanctuary, where she could stretch her cramped legs and arms, lie down, and pray. Anne swallowed the mouthful of soup.
So, did Jigang say you were to do more to me than feed me? Perhaps rough me up for his amusement or yours?
No, Sister Alessandra sighed. Just feed you.
From what I gather, he hasn't decided what to do with you. But in the meantime, he wants you kept alive so you might be of value to him one day.
Anne watched the woman stir the bowl of soup.
He can't get in your mind, you know. Not now.
Sister Alessandra looked up. What makes you think that?
The chimes are loose.
The spoon stilled.
So I've heard.
The spoon again started circling.
Rumors, that's all it is.
Anne squirmed, trying to get more comfortable on the rough ground. It seemed to her that with all her natural padding, she shouldn't be so troubled by lumps on the ground.
I wish it were only rumors.
Why do you think your magic doesn't work?
But it does. I mean, your additive magic.
The woman's brown eyes turned down.
Well, I guess I've not really tried to use it, that's all.
If I were to try, it would work, I've no doubt.
Try then. You'll see I'm right.
She shook her head. His Excellency does not permit it unless he specifically requests it. It is unwise to do other than His Excellency says to do. Anne leaned toward the woman.
Alessandra, the chimes are loose. Magic has failed. For creation's sake, why do you think I'm in this predicament? If I could use magic, don't you think I would have caused just a little trouble when I was captured? Use your head, Alessandra. You're not stupid. Don't act it.
There was one thing about Alessandra she wasn't stupid. How a smart woman could fall prey to the keeper's promises she didn't know. She guessed lies could fool even smart people. Anne avoided using the appellation sister, not only because it was a term of respect, but because it seemed a way of speaking more directly, more intimately to a woman Anne had known and liked for half a millennium. Using the title sister seemed only to invoke her connection to the Sisters of the Dark.
Alessandra, Jigang can't get into your head. His power as a dreamwalker has failed, just the same as my power has failed.
Sister Alessandra watched without evident emotion.
Perhaps his power works in conjunction with, or even through, ours, and he could still get into the minds of the Sisters of the Dark. Bah! Now you're thinking like a slave. Go away if you're going to think like a slave, like the Sisters of the Light, I'm ashamed to say.
The woman seemed reluctant, either to leave or to end the discussion.
I don't believe you.
Jigang is all-powerful. He must surely be watching now through my eyes as we speak, and I simply don't know it. Anne was forced to take the spoonful of soup when it unexpectedly swooped toward her mouth. She chewed slowly as she studied the woman's face.
You could come back to the light, Alessandra.
What? The instantaneous flash of anger in the woman's eyes melted to amusement.
Prillet, you have gone loony.
Have I?
Sister Alessandra pressed another spoonful to Anne's lips.
Yes. I am sworn to my master of the underworld. I serve the keeper. Eat, now.
Before Anne could swallow, another spoonful came at her. She ate a half dozen more before she could get a word out.
Alessandra, the Creator, would forgive you. The Creator is all-loving and all-forgiving. He would take you back. You could come back to the light. Wouldn't you like to return to the Creator's loving embrace?
Unexpectedly, Sister Alessandra backhanded her. Anne toppled to her side. The woman hovered, glowering.
The Keeper is my master. You will not speak blasphemy.
His Excellency is my master in this world. In the next, I am sworn to the Keeper. I will not listen to you profane my oath to my master. Do you hear? Anne feared that what healing her jaw had done had now been undone. It hurt, something awful. Her eyes watered. Sister Alessandra finally seized Anne's filthy dress at the shoulder and hauled her up straight.
I will not have you saying such things, do you hear?
Anne kept silent, fearing to elicit another angry outburst. Apparently the subject was as sore as Anne's jaw. Sister Alessandra picked up the bowl of soup.
There isn't much left, but you should finish it.
Alessandra stared down at the bowl, as if watching the spoon stirring around in it. She cleared her throat.
Sorry I hit you.
Anne nodded.
I forgive you, Alessandra.
The woman's eyes, no longer filled with anger, turned up.
I do, Alessandra,
Anne whispered sincerely, wondering at the terrible emotion struggling within her former disciple. The eyes turned down again.
There's nothing to forgive. I am what I am, and nothing will change it.
You've no idea of the things I've done to become a Sister of the Dark. She looked up with a distant expression.
You've no idea of the power I was granted in return. You can't imagine, prelate.
Anne almost asked her what good it did her, but held her tongue and finished the soup in silence. She winced in pain with every swallow. The spoon clanked when Alessandra dropped it in the empty bowl.
It was very good, Alessandra. The best meal I've had in however long I've been here. Weeks, I guess.
Sister Alessandra nodded and rose. If I'm not busy, I will bring you some tomorrow, then.
Alessandra,
the woman turned back. Anne met her gaze.
Could you sit with me for a bit?
Why? Anne chuckled bitterly.
I'm stuffed in a box every day.
I'm staked to the ground every night. It would be nice to have someone I know sit with me for a bit, that's all.
I'm a sister of the dark.
Anne shrugged.
I'm a sister of the light. You still brought me soup.
I was ordered to.
Ah, more honesty than I received from the sisters of the light, I'm sorry to say.
Anne squirmed off a loop of chain and then flopped down on her side, turning away from Sister Alessandra.
Sorry you had to be interrupted to take care of me. Jigang probably wants you to go back to whoring for his men.
Silence reigned inside the tent. Outside, soldiers laughed, drank, and gambled. Smells of meat roasting drifted in. At least Anne's stomach wasn't grumbling with hunger. The soup had been good. Anne heard the sound of a woman's scream in the distance. The scream turned to chiming laughter. One of the camp followers, no doubt. Sometimes the screams were sincere terror. Sometimes the sound of them made Anne sweat, thinking about what was happening to those poor women. At last, Sister Alessandra sank back down.
I could sit with you a bit.
Anne rolled over.
I would like that, Alessandra. I really would.
Sister Alessandra helped her sit up, and then the two of them sat in awkward silence while they listened to the camp sounds.
Jagang's tent, Anne said at last. I heard it was something, quite the fancy sight.
Yes, it is. It's like a palace he sets up each night. I can't say I favor going there, though.
No, after my encounter with the man, I imagine not.
Do you know where we're going? The other shook her head. Here, there, it makes no difference. We are slaves serving His Excellency. It had the ring of hopelessness to it, and made Anne think to gently turn that feeling to hope.
You know, Alessandra, he can't get into my mind.
Sister Alessandra looked up with a frown, and Anne told her how the bond to the Lord Rawl protected anyone sworn to him. Anne was careful to frame it in terms of what it meant to her and to the others sworn to Richard on a personal level, rather than to make it sound like an offer. The woman listened without objection.
Now, Anne said in conclusion, the magic of Richard's bond as the Lord Rawl doesn't work,
but then Jigang's magic doesn't work either, so I'm still safe from the Dreamwalker. She chuckled.
Unless he walks in the tent, that is.
Sister Alessandra laughed with her. Anne rearranged her manacled hands in her lap, hauling the chains closer so she could have enough slack to cross her legs.
When the chimes eventually go back to your master in the underworld, then Richard's bond will work again, and I will once again be protected from Jigang's magic when it returns too. In all this, that is the one comfort I have, knowing I'm safe from Jigang's power entering my mind.
Sister Alessandra sat mute.
Of course, Anne added. It must be a relief for you to be without Jigang in your mind for the time being, at least.
You don't know when he's there. You feel no different, except if he wants you to know. She smoothed the lap of her dress when Anne didn't say anything.
But I think you don't know what you're talking about, prelate. The Dreamwalker is in my mind right now, watching us.
She looked up, waiting for Anne to argue. Instead, Anne said,
You just think on it, Alessandra. You just think on it.
Sister Alessandra gathered up the bowl. I'd best be going back.
Thank you for coming, Alessandra. Thank you for the soup. And thank you for sitting with me. It was nice to be with you again.
Sister Alessandra nodded and ducked out of the tent. Chapter 50. Although it was hardly noticeable, the grassy ground stretching to the horizon before Beata's Domini Dirch was slightly higher than the ground to each side of the enormous stone weapon, and so provided firmer footing, especially for horses. After the recent rains, the gentle swale to the right was muddy. To the left, it wasn't any better. Because of the unique lay of the land, especially after rain, people tended to approach Beata's post, her Domini Dirch, more often than others. There weren't many, but those in the area traveling into Andorath from the grasslands of the wilds were inclined to come to her station first. Beata enjoyed being able to be in charge for a change, to pass judgment on people and say if they could enter. If she thought they looked like people who should not be let in, she sent them on to a border station where they could apply for entry with the station guards. It felt good to be the one in control of important matters instead of being helpless. Now she decided things. It was exciting, too, when travelers came through. Something different, a chance to talk to people from afar or to see their strange dress. There were rarely more than two or three people traveling together, but they looked up to her. She was in charge. This bright, sunny morning, though, Vieta's heart hammered against her ribs. This time, those who approached were different. This time, there were considerably more than a few. This time, it looked like a true threat. "Karine," Vieta ordered. "Stand ready at the striker." The Haken woman squinted over at her. "You sure, Sergeant?" Karine had terrible eyesight. She rarely saw anything beyond 30 paces, and these people were off at the horizon. It was something Vieta had never done before, ordering out the striker, at least not when people approached. They practiced taking it out, of course, but she'd never ordered it out. If she wasn't there, the ones on duty were supposed to take it out if they judged a threat approached, but with Vieta there, it was up to her to order it readied. She was in charge. They depended on her. Since the terrible accident, they'd added an extra bar across the rack where the striker stood. Even though they knew it wasn't the striker that had rung the weapon, no one told them to do it. Vieta just felt better with another restraint on the striker. It made them feel like they were doing something about the accident, even if they weren't really. No one knew why all the Dominie Dirch had rung. Vieta wiped her sweaty palms on her hips. "I'm sure. Do it." Other times when people approached, it was easy enough to tell they were harmless. Traders with a cart, some of the nomadic people of the wilds, wanting to trade with the soldiers stationed at the border. Vieta never let them through. Merchants, taking an unusual route for one reason or another. Even some special Ander guard troops returning from far patrols. Those Ander guard troops weren't regular army soldiers. They were special. They were men only, and they looked to Vieta like they were used to dealing with trouble of one sort or another. They paid no heed to regular Andereth soldiers like Vieta. She'd ordered them to stop once as they approached. Vieta knew who they were because Captain Tolbert had instructed her and her squad about the special Ander guard troops and told them to let the men pass at will if they came by. She'd only wanted to ask them, being fellow soldiers and all, if they needed anything. They didn't stop when she ordered it. The man leading simply smirked as he rode past with his column of big men. These people who approached, though, were not guard troops. Vieta didn't know what to make of them, except they had the look of a serious threat. She could make out hundreds of mounted soldiers in dark uniforms spreading out as they halted. Even from a distance, it was a formidable sight. Vieta glanced to her side and saw Karine drawing back the striker. Annette seized the shaft to help strike the Dominie Dirch. Vieta sprang toward them and caught the shaft of the striker before they could swing it. "No order what's given. What's the matter with you? Stand down."
"But, Sergeant," Annette complained, "they're soldiers, a lot of soldiers, and they aren't ours. I can tell that much."
Vieta shoved the woman back.
"They're giving the signal. Can't you see?"
"But, Sergeant Vieta," Annette whined, "they aren't our people. They've no business."
"You don't even know their business yet."
Vieta was frightened and angry that Karine and Annette had almost rung the weapon on their own.
"Are you crazy? You don't even know who they are. You could be killing innocent people."
"You're both going to stand in extra duty tonight and for the next week for not following orders. Do you understand?" Annette hung her head. Karine saluted, not knowing how she was supposed to react to such discipline. Vieta would have been angry at any of her squad trying to wrongly ring the Dominie Dirch, but deep down inside, she was glad it was the two Haken women and not one of the Anders. On the horizon, a person on horseback waved a white flag on the end of a pole or lance. Vieta didn't know the distance the Dominie Dirch could kill. Maybe if Karine and Danette had rung it, it wouldn't have harmed the people out there, but after what happened to Turner, she hoped never to see the weapon rung while people were in front of it, unless they clearly were attacking. Vieta watched as the strange troops waited where they were while only a few people approached. Those were the rules, the way Vieta and her squad were taught. People had to wave a flag of some sort, and if there were many, only a few were supposed to approach to state their business and ask permission to pass. It wasn't a risk to have a few people approach. Dominie Dirch could kill an enemy even if they were only one step away, out in front of it. They would still die. How close people came was really irrelevant. So was the number, for that matter. Four people, two on foot and two on horseback, came forward, leaving the rest behind. As they got closer, she could see it was two men and two women. One man and woman rode, the other pair walked. There was something about the woman on horseback. When Beata realized who the woman had to be, her heart felt as if it had leaped up into her throat. "You see?" Beata said to Corrine and Danette. "Can you imagine if you'd rung that thing? Can you imagine?" The two, jaws agape, stared out at the approaching people. Beata's knees trembled at the thought of what had almost happened. Beata turned and shook a fist at the two. "Put that thing away. Don't you dare go near the Dominie Dirch. Do you understand?" Both saluted. Beata turned and raced down the steps, two at a time. In her whole life, she never imagined anything like this. She never imagined she would actually meet the Mother Confessor herself. She gaped, along with the rest of her squad, who came out to see, as the woman in the long white dress rode forward. One man rode to her right. A man and a woman were on foot. The woman was pregnant. The man on foot, on the Mother Confessor's left, was dressed in loose clothes of no particular style. He had a sword, but kept it sheathed. The man riding on the Mother Confessor's right was something else entirely. Beata had never seen such a man, all dressed in black, with a golden cape billowing out behind. The sight took her breath.